We want to thank our sponsors of this special On Location visit to Normandy, France: DAV of Minnesota, Chanhassen American Legion Post 580, and Minnesota Military and Veterans Museum. Welcome to Minnesota Military Radio. This is a special occasion here, a great special treat. We are recording live right now in Normandy, France, with some of our great sponsors. Minnesota Military Radio is able to travel over here with great support from the American Legion Post 580, the DAV of Minnesota, and the Minnesota Military and Veteran Museum. We're here to commemorate the 80th anniversary of D-Day. 80 years ago, on June 6, 1944, nearly 160,000 Allied troops landed in Normandy. 75,000 of those were U.S. forces. While discussing the events of D-Day, you'll hear stories of Minnesota service members who fought in the quest to liberate Europe. I'm honored to have a couple of co-hosts helping me out through the next series of shows here, and I'd like to start with our first co-host, do a nice introduction of him. His name is Doug Thompson. He's the curator of the Minnesota Military and Veterans Museum at Camp Ripley. Doug, welcome to Minnesota Military Radio.
Thanks. It's a real pleasure to be here in Normandy with the team that we've assembled for this commemorative event, and I'm looking forward to adding some insight to our trip over the next couple of days and telling these Minnesota veteran stories.
Well, we're excited to be here. Again, we're on site, and we're in Bayou right now, and this is kind of the I wouldn't say necessarily epicenter, right? We know what that is, but this is a great location for us to be just simply because of the proximity to the different things that we're going to be talking about over the next several segments. But before we kind of get in and lay all that out, I want to establish who you are and talk a little bit about what your interest is in D-Day. I mean, obviously, you're a history buff. You work at the museum, but we have you along because you've got some just exceptional expertise. So let's talk a little bit about you and what got you interested in this whole World War II and D-Day.
Sure, great. Well, you know, as a son of a veteran, the grandson of a veteran, and a family military history that really traces back almost to the time of the American Revolution, I've had an interest in military history as it relates to my own family. My dad's older brother is an Omaha Beach veteran. He landed on the evening of June 6th. And so my entire interest in D-Day and Normandy and World War II in general really stems from the family members that I have that were involved in military service in wartime and in peace. You know, I've been studying World War II since I was able to read a book. My interest has been fostered over the years by books, movies, veterans that I knew, veterans that were teachers of mine in high school, people that I didn't know were veterans throughout high school because they never talked about their service. It's that humbleness of that greatest generation that didn't really want to talk about the war and didn't have an interest in lauding their own activities. And I know through my studies that they deserve to be lauded, they deserve to be remembered, they deserve to be commemorated, and I'm happy to be here to help with that.
Well, we're again excited to have you here, and we know that with the new museum that's being built up at Camp Ripley, you're going to have an opportunity to do some special tributes to this era and have some great things on display. Maybe you can tell us just a little bit about what those plans look like.
Yeah, that's great. Well, you know, the Minnesota Military and Veterans Museum has been around since 1977. Over that time, we've accumulated hundreds, if not thousands, of veteran stories and artifacts. Our current museum facility is in a 90-year-old regimental headquarters building, never designed to really be a museum building. We've done what we could with it. We decided that Minnesotans and veterans deserved a better place to tell their story. So over the past several years, we did a fundraising campaign, and to date have raised $37.5 million to build a new state-of-the-art, world-class Minnesota Military and Veterans Museum right in the heart of Minnesota. It'll tell the stories of veterans from all 87 counties. We're going from a facility that's 5,000 square feet to over 40,000 square feet. This facility will allow us great opportunities to highlight veteran stories, to expand on some of the galleries that we already have, and to have an opportunity to teach the younger generation. You know, in another very short amount of time, we're not going to have any World War II veterans left. The Vietnam veterans are aging, and someday even the global war on terror is going to be ancient history. We want to be able to tell those stories to students, to visitors, to educators, to let them know about those sacrifices and to keep the memory of what they did alive and for future generations.
You know, one of the things that I noticed is that you don't ever turn it off. Every conversation we've had, you've got a touch of history that you can bring into it. And one of the interesting things that I thought was that it wasn't soon after we got here in the Bayou, you were already doing some then and now type of photos. How do you store all of this information and have the ability just to recall?
You know, I think with any passion that anybody has, you know, I don't remember what I had for breakfast yesterday, but I can tell you stories of veterans from wars long ago and recount in great detail because I have an interest in it. The then and now photographs is really a result of my friendship with our co-host, Dominique Francois, who will be speaking with in a moment, and the ability to be able to capture that history and to let people know that, you know, this happened 80 years ago, but it's still fresh in the minds of a lot of people, especially the people of Normandy, who are very grateful for the allies, the British, Canadians, Americans, and all the other allies that helped liberate Normandy and liberate Europe. So being able to capture that history and to compare it with what happened 80 years ago, to me, is fascinating. And the then and now photographs speak to that history. It shows that history isn't that old, you know.
Yeah, you're right. History is not that old at all. So we're here at the Churchill Hotel. We're in Bayou. And, you know, as the initial planning was going on to get this trip established, we weren't sure if we were going to be able to make it happen. You know, with partners like you in the museum, we were able to pull this thing off. What does it mean to you to be able to represent the Minnesota Military and Veterans Museum, to be here on site with Minnesota Military Radio and put together what's going to be a fantastic series of interviews and telling these great stories of our Minnesota service members, and then something that will be able to be collected for the museum to have forever?
Well, I'm unbelievably honored because my study of the Battle of Normandy, when I was a kid, I never ever dreamed that I'd be able to come here. I visited 10 years ago with my friend Dom, and the ability to actually walk in the footsteps of these men gives you a sense of history that you can't get from reading a book. I think the stories that we gather here today and that we're able to share with our audience is going to be very impactful, and telling those stories from here gives you a little extra emphasis to do a good job. And I can't say enough about the staff at the Minnesota Military Museum, the board of directors, and everybody that supported our museum in the past. And I think the content that we get here today will be phenomenal, and it will be able to speak to future generations as to what happened here.
This is my first time here in Normandy in France. You've been here before. I know the gravity I felt when I just went to Washington, D.C. to our memorials there. What can we expect as a listener, as a host for this show, when we get to the actual sites?
You're going to see cliche, but the spots where all this stuff happened. You know, standing in the middle of the Normandy American Military Cemetery is really touching. You know, there's 20,000 American soldiers that died in the Battle of Normandy, 138,000 died to liberate Western Europe. And all those 20,000 American soldiers that were killed in Normandy, 10,000 of them are buried in the cemetery, which we will be visiting in a very short amount of time. I don't think any American could stand in that cemetery and not have a sense of awe of the sacrifices that were made at that time.
Well, we're looking forward to the stories, hearing about the great service of our Minnesota military members. We're going to take a quick break right here. We'll come back. We'll let you introduce our next co-host. This is Doug Wortham with Minnesota Military Radio. Please stay with us. We'll be right back. Thank you to our feature co-sponsor, Chanhassen American Legion Post 580. The post is a pillar of the community and lives up to the vision of continuing service to our country through service to the community. American Legion Chanhassen Post 580 was formed in 1952 by World War II veterans. Sponsorship of our commemoration of the 80th anniversary of D-Day honors their memory and sends a clear message that they will support veterans, service members, and military families of all eras. Thank you, Chanhassen American Legion Post 580, for your sponsorship of Minnesota Military Radio's commemoration of the 80th anniversary of D-Day from Normandy, France. Welcome back to Minnesota Military Radio. I'm your host, Doug Wortham. Again, we are recording live here in Bayeux, France, and I'm here with one of my co-hosts, Doug Thompson. And Doug, we're talking in the last segment a little bit about your history, your passion, and we've got a special co-host, someone you've known for a little while, who probably isn't has a little bit more of a vested interest in what has happened here. Why don't you go ahead and introduce this very special guest for us?
Great, and it's a real honor for me to introduce my friend Dom Francois. Dom is one of the preeminent historians of the Battle of Normandy. He's lived here all of his life. He's a noted author of over 20 books on the Battle of Normandy, to include histories of the units that were involved, battles that took place, a very well-known series of then and now books. And Dom and his family I've known for about 15 years now, and I'm honored to call him a good friend. And I'm looking forward to spending the next couple of days with Dom going over the battlefields with you guys. So,
well, Dominic, it's a pleasure to have you, and welcome to Minnesota Military Radio.
Many thanks first. I'm very proud and to be your host today.
Well, I'll tell you what, it couldn't have happened any better as the planning was taking place. And when we found out that Doug had a special relationship with somebody here in Normandy, and then to find out and read your pedigree and the things that you've done, obviously you've written books, you've done private tours here in Normandy, you've got a lot of experience and knowledge, and I'd like to just get to know you a little bit. Tell us a little bit about what you do, and how things are going here for you.
First of all, I am not an historian. I was all my career. I was a nurse, and finished my career as a nurse practitioner. And but I have always been very interested about the Battle of Normandy, and that's the reason why I decided to study the Battle of Normandy, to write several books on this subject. But it's probably also as a Norman child. I have lived in the middle of a country which has been destroyed and damaged, and a lot of bunkers everywhere, and a lot of stories about the war. So it was the beginning of my interest of the Battle of Normandy, and also because what's happened to my family.
Well, we'd like to talk a little bit about that. You have just an unbelievable story, a personal tie to D-Day, and not different from, many people in the area obviously have a personal tie, have been somehow affected. But I think your story is pretty unique. Not only do we have you here to tell us, but that's unique in itself, but it's a powerful story, which really kind of brings to light why you have the passion you do for D-Day, and the appreciation, as you've stated to me previously, for the American troops and for the Allied troops. So how about if you tell us a little bit about how it all started, the story of your grandfather, your father, and the things that happened on D-Day?
Yes. My grandfather was an officer in First World War and in the French cavalry. And he survived the war after 6 long years of in service. And he decided that after the war, he wanted to become a farmer, to meet a wife and to have children. And it's what he did. And he married, had 3 boys. And unfortunately, on June 1940, the Germans invade France, and they arrive in Normandy. And they arrived to his farm, and one officer said to my grandfather, "You have 5 minutes to get out of your house. Your house will be occupied by 4 German soldiers. And at that time, you don't have 6 minutes. You have better to leave very quickly." So it's what he did. But as soon as the officer left the house, one of the German soldiers told him, "You can come back. We will stay in one bedroom, and you can keep the other bedroom for your family." So now you had 4 German soldiers in my grandfather's house, and they succeeded to live together. And in 1942, my grandmother died. She was sick, and so my grandfather decided to adopt a niece who have, her parents have been killed during a Paris exodus, during a German strafing on a road. And this young teenager was alone. And my grandfather decided to adopt her to help him to take care of the boys and to take care of the house. So she came and lived with them in the house. And on the same time, the Germans decided to build a big German bunker battery near the farm, and with big guns to protect the coast. And unfortunately, on the day before D-Day, the 5th of June, the Allies decided to bomb the battery because it was very dangerous for the invasion. Unfortunately, the bombing was not very accurate at that time, and several bombs arrived on the village, killing a lot of civilians. And among the civilians, my grandfather and Aline, the niece, were killed by a bomb. And my father and one of his brothers succeed to escape from the house, and they arrive in the village completely panicked and asking assistance. But it was not possible because there was dead people everywhere in the village. So a civilian told them, "Go in the church, and we will wait you tomorrow when after the bombing." And the first Americans arrived on D-Day in the village. It was some paratroopers of the 82nd Airborne. And with the help of some civilians and few paratroopers, they succeeded to find the body of my grandfather. And under the body of my grandfather, there was their brother who was unconscious, but he was still alive. And so now you have 3 boys. Her 2 parents are dead. And the battle is not finished because Saint-Marcouf, the town, was liberated but recaptured by the German, recaptured by the American. And so the 3 boys followed the Americans. So, and they start to connect with the Americans. And they receive some chocolate bar, shrimp gum, sea ration, and they had wonderful time with them. And the Americans were very generous. And a few weeks later, it was decided by the Americans to build an airstrip near the village. And the 3 boys used to go to see the aircraft because they have never seen an aircraft and a plane. And my father was at that time some teeth problem, and there was an American dentist who took care of him.
Now, you were saying in another conversation we had that, you know, despite the loss of his parents, that couple of months with those American soldiers were some of the best times of his life.
Yes, yes. My father, when I was a kid, used to say that we must a lot. We owe a lot to the Americans. They have paid a big price for our freedom, and we must never forget what they did for our liberty and freedom.
Well, we're absolutely ecstatic to have you on the show with us and share your personal story as you just did, and we're really looking forward to getting into the knowledge that you have about the different sites that that we're going to be visiting and telling those stories. And we've got Doug here that'll be sharing some of the connections back to our Minnesota service members. And we just can't thank you enough. We really appreciate the fact that you're going to spend some time here with us. And, you know, you've been here your whole life. And so we're gonna really rely on you to tell us what really happened. And, you know, we appreciate the things that you've done and the amount of time you've spent doing the research.
Oh, thank you very much. I forget to thank Doug because he's a great historian. And I have wonderful time when I visit Camp Ripley with him. And thank you for that.
All right, perfect. We're going to take a quick break here, and we'll come back and we'll continue the conversation with our two co-hosts. This is Doug Wortham with Minnesota Military Radio. Thank you to our feature co-sponsor, DAV of Minnesota. With more than 19,000 members and 32 chapters across the state, DAV of Minnesota was built on the concept of veterans serving veterans. DAV of Minnesota provides a network of services and leads the way to provide a lifetime of services to veterans of all military branches and eras. DAV of Minnesota fulfills our nation's promises to the men and women who served. Thank you, DAV of Minnesota, for your sponsorship of Minnesota Military Radio's commemoration of the 80th anniversary of D-Day from Normandy, France. Welcome back to Minnesota Military Radio. This is a special edition of Minnesota Military Radio. We are commemorating the 80th anniversary of D-Day, and we're recording here on location in Bayeux, France, and I'm joined by the curator of the Minnesota Military and Veteran Museum, Doug Thompson, along with the noted author and D-Day expert, we'll call him, Dominique Francois. And gentlemen, first off, again, appreciate you being here. And we want to get into, you know, the conversation of D-Day, what took place on June 6, 1944. But let's talk about some of the events that led up to that. Dom, I'd like to start with you. Maybe you can just kind of tell us, what was it like here in the area? What was the normal French life like in Normandy?
You mean at the beginning of the war?
Yeah, just in general, right? I mean, before 1944, you know, you mentioned about the soldiers that took over your grandfather's farm. But how were the people treated when this area was occupied by the Germans before D-Day?
A lot of restriction. I would say that, this word restriction. When the Germans arrive in Normandy, and as all France, they decided that to organize some restriction for the French, food restriction, and they captured all the horses, all the cows, all the food that they can send in Germany. And then there was a curfew. There was a lot of restriction also about for the Jew. For example, the Jew had to wear a yellow star. And there was a lot of restriction about the place to go. Restriction also in the town, so no more than three people together. All gathering were forbidden, and a lot of all the coastal roads were closed for the civilians. It was forbidden to go on the coast. So there was a lot of restriction, which changed the life of the Normans.
So we wouldn't say it was a normal life as it was prior to the occupation. Doug, I'll come over to you. You know, so the French are trying to make the best of life as they can while they're occupied. And we know that Operation Overlord, that didn't just take place overnight, meaning the planning. There was obviously a lot of planning that went into it. So maybe you can tell us a little bit about the preparation of the planning for what we know would now become D-Day.
Sure. I mean, they have been planning Operation Overlord for over 2 years. They knew that the bombing campaign of Germany wasn't going to affect an end of the war. They knew that they had to land in France and physically reconquer the territory that was occupied by the Germans to facilitate the end of the war. That wasn't going to happen without putting troops on the beaches and building up those beachheads and being able to chase the Germans out of France and eventually to the gates of Berlin. This 2 years of planning was an enormous effort by the Allies and the French resistance, which were very helpful with disrupting German rail lines, communications over D-Day. But at one point, there were over 2 million Allied soldiers in England waiting for the invasion of Normandy. What did this look like? Every open field had stores, had vehicles, had aircraft, an immense amount of planning. It's staggering to think of all of the different little aspects that they had to consider for the invasion. The tides, they had to send in underwater swimmers to figure out what the tides were like on the Norman beaches. What was the soil composition of the beaches? The minutiae and the detail that they had to go into for planning the invasion was spectacular. And it took all of those 2 years to be able to put those men on those beaches and to take over the territory here in Normandy.
You know, so obviously there's planning going on for 2 years for the invasion. And Dom, over that period of time, it's not like the Germans were just sitting idle. They were building obstacles in putting things in place on the beach, the Atlantic Wall. Can you tell us or describe a little bit about what that was and what the purpose was?
So, yes, the Atlantic Wall was a long, long wall from Norway to Spain, and with a lot of defense on the coastline, a lot of bunkers with big guns, and with also defense for against the infantry, like machine gun and mortars, but a lot of obstacles also on the beaches. And behind this coast defense, there was also a lot of obstacle inland. All the areas where some paratrooper or gliders can land have received a lot of obstacles with landmines. And so all these areas were covered of booby traps, obstacles, all the way off the coast.
When I think about movies like Saving Private Ryan, the old movie The Longest Day, and they portrayed the beach and showed these obstacles that our service members, the Allied forces, when they were landing, what they had to go through, was that pretty accurate?
I think it was pretty accurate when I remember to have talked with a veteran of who landed at Omaha Beach, and when he saw the first 30 minutes of Saving Private Ryan, he told me that it was exactly like this. The only thing that was missing was the smell on the bridge, on the beach of the wounded and the dead soldier. But it seems to have been very accurate of all these obstacles. Yes.
And so, Doug, the planning that was going on, obviously there had to be intel. They knew that there were going to be obstacles that they had to breach, you know, the wall. What kind of preparation went into that to be able to get past those obstacles?
When they were figuring out where these obstacles were, a lot of their information came from aerial photography, but a lot of their information also came from the French Resistance. The French Resistance were sending back coded messages telling where German troops were, where lines of communication were at, where some of these landmine fields were. And so Allied intelligence combined with the information of the French Resistance painted a pretty clear picture of what the beaches and the landing areas behind were like. And so together working with our French friends, we were able to get a pretty good idea of what they were going to be facing on the beaches.
Now, Dominic, we've been in country for just a couple of days, and it's rained every day. What was the weather like? Because I know that was a major factor in whether or not the invasion was going to take place on the 6th or the 5th or before that. So talk to us about how the weather really impacted D-Day.
Yes, I think we have exactly the same weather that they had on the 6th of June. It was rainy, and the ocean was rough, and it was very cloudy. So it was very difficult for the airborne force. It was very difficult for the seaborne troops. So, but there was this little window on the 6th of June that permit to the American and the Allies to land on D-Day, but it was a very short window of weather, but it was still very difficult for the troop to land on D-Day.
And we know that the original intent was to go on the 5th. The weather paused the operation, and then on the 6th it happened. And of course, the rest is history. And we're going to talk about a lot of that history over the next several segments. And so we got the great overview, the big picture, so to speak. We're going to tee it up, and when we come back, we'll talk about that first operation that took place on June 6th, 1944, or the preparation for the Allied forces to land. This is Minnesota Military Radio. Again, we are recording live here in Bayeux, France, with a special edition of Minnesota Military Radio. Please stay with us. Thank you to our feature co-sponsor, the Minnesota Military and Veterans Museum. Located at Camp Ripley, the museum strengthens public understanding of how armed conflict and military institutions have shaped Minnesota's and the nation's experience. Minnesotans are mobilizing to build a new world-class military and veterans museum at Camp Ripley, opening in 2026. More information at mnvetmuseum.org. Thank you, Minnesota Military and Veteran Museum, for your sponsorship of Minnesota Military Radio's commemoration of the 80th anniversary of D-Day from Normandy, France. Welcome back to Minnesota Military Radio. Again, we are commemorating the 80th anniversary of D-Day, and we're recording here in Bayeux, France. I'm joined by the curator of the Minnesota Military and Veteran Museum, Doug Thompson, and noted author and D-Day expert, Dominique Francois. Gentlemen, just fantastic overview so far, getting to know you, talking about the planning that went into this, and the day was set. We know that weather played a role in why June 6th was selected, after kind of pausing the invasion for a day or so. Everybody thought they were going on the 5th. Weather said no, and it was decided we're moving in on the 6th. But there was some things that had to happen in order for the entire operation to be successful. And the first operation was something called Pegasus Bridge. And I think that people who have seen the movie The Longest Day, they've seen these gliders come in to secure Pegasus Bridge. But Doug, I wanted to start with you. I mean, really, what was the importance of Pegasus Bridge? Why was that the target? Why was it so important for those British gliders to come in and take over that bridge?
Sure. Well, in terms of the overall beaches, there was Utah, Omaha, Gold, Juneau, and Sword. And Sword was on the far eastern end of the invasion flank. the Pegasus Bridge and the nearby Horsa Bridge, which was also captured, was of paramount importance for securing that eastern flank. They needed to capture those bridges to keep Germans from bringing in armor and reinforcements to attack that eastern bridgehead, but they also needed those bridges for them to break out of that eastern bridgehead, so that those two bridges are going to allow the British and the Canadians to move along the flanks of the Germans and secure their bridgehead and have breathing room for the thousands and tens of thousands and hundreds of tanks and men and vehicles that were going to have to make that assault.
And it was important for the Allied forces to take that bridge as quiet as possible, and that kind of set the stage.
It is. So the bridge assault was led by a man named Major John Howard of the Oxford and Buckinghamshire Light Infantry. The plan was for three gliders to land on Pegasus Bridge and three gliders to land on Horsa Bridge. The dramatic story of D-Day is when just a few minutes after midnight, Major Howard and his three gliders full of men, about 30 men in each glider, silently landed right next to Pegasus Bridge. The lead glider with Major Howard, the nose of the glider actually broke through the barbed wire barricade that they had around the bridge. It was that close. The nose of the glider was about 50 feet away from the bridge at that time. The British had been training for this operation for 2 years, along with all the other training that was going on. They silently and professionally went in and subdued the German defenses. And in a little under 15 minutes, with the loss of only one man killed in action, the first American soldier killed on, or first Allied soldier killed on D-Day was a young lieutenant named Den Brothridge, who's buried in a nearby cemetery. And the only KIA in that first initial assault on Pegasus Bridge, it was an extremely successful operation.
And so, Dominic, Pegasus Bridge, I know that you know a lot about this. From your perspective, what was the importance of that site?
But as I said, Doug, the site was very important because it was the east flank of the invasion, and these two bridges on the canal and on the river were very important because German tanks would have been able to come and to pass this bridge and would have been able to go on Sword Beach, would have been very dangerous for the invasion. So these two bridges was very important, yes.
And Doug has pointed out a few times that you know everybody in the area. And so you know somebody that was very close to Pegasus Bridge.
Yes, there was a very famous bar near the bridge, and which became famous because they opened the bar to welcome the first British paratroopers, and the veterans used to come back and visit the bar, and the family is still there, and the name of this family is Gondret, and it's a very famous bar, and the daughter of the family still owns the bar and is very honored to receive British veterans and families on this bar. Yes.
Doug, I'll come back to you. One of the really interesting things I thought, this is a reference to the movie The Longest Day, is that when that scene took place and the gliders came in, and obviously the mission was accomplished, but there was a notable figure playing a bagpipe. First question is, was that an accurate depiction, and what can you tell us about that person?
That would be Piper Bill Millen of the 1st Special Service Force. This was a commando unit led by a Scottish major named Lord Lovett, and they were tasked with relieving the forces on Pegasus Bridge. they had to hold the bridges, but they had to have reinforcements that could come in and relieve them. The commander of this unit, Lord Lovett, had his own personal Piper Bill Millen, play the bagpipes up and down the beach to inspire his men. He didn't carry a weapon. His only job on D-Day was to play the bagpipes. Having spoken with Bill Millen personally and having been able to spend an entire day with this gentleman, he thought his commanding officer was crazy to have him playing the bagpipes up and down the beach. In terms of the movie The Longest Day, when you see the bagpiper in this column of British commandos relieving the bridge, very accurate. You know, when the British glider troops, John Howard's men, were on Pegasus Bridge, they heard these bagpipes before they saw the British troops coming. They knew relief was on the way.
Yeah, what a fantastic story. And we know that, you know, the bands, so to speak, are there to provide morale to the troops. And I would imagine that hearing that bagpipe for the troops was that motivation to keep on going. I mean, here's this person who's unarmed. And, you know, whether or not there was bullets flying overhead or around him, he just kept on moving and playing and leading those troops forward.
Yeah, Bill Millen fought throughout the war playing his bagpipes and never got so much as a scratch. He attributed it to the Germans not wanting to shoot at him because they thought he was crazy. I think it's more blind, dumb luck that he didn't get killed or wounded playing those bagpipes and inspiring his men.
So we have just 2 minutes left here in this part of the segment. We've done a full show now, getting to know the two of you. We've talked about Operation Overlord, the big picture, and now Pegasus Bridge. And Dom, without the success of Pegasus Bridge, do you think that D-Day itself would have been what it was?
Difficult to say, but probably it would have been more difficult if the SS Panzer Division would have been able to arrive on the beach and probably to repulse some of the troops of Sword or maybe Gaulle. And yes, it would have been more casualties, more deadly for the Allied.
All right. So Dominic and Doug, this is a wrap for this show. We are going to continue to have conversations as we now go out and see some of the sites and start hearing those Minnesota connections. And I just want to say thanks for this initial get to know you segment. We really appreciate it. This is Minnesota Military Radio, and we're commemorating the 80th anniversary of D-Day. We are here in Normandy, France, and please continue to tune in with us as we will start to share the Minnesota connections, the Minnesota stories, and talk about D-Day, the invasion here in Normandy, and how the Allied forces helped to liberate Europe. This is Minnesota Military Radio.